It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we find out why transgender state workers in Wisconsin won't get insurance coverage for gender reassignment services anymore.
First, just days before a primary election for Wisconsin State Superintendent of Education, a story broke about an effort at apparent collusion between two candidates in the race. At issue here, an alleged offer of a six-figure taxpayer-funded job for one candidate to drop out of the race. Here's candidate John Humphreys making an accusation against his opponent, Lowell Holtz, speaking on WISN Radio.
I've been forthright about my background, but on December 22nd, Dr. Holtz and I agreed to meet at a Milton family restaurant to talk teamwork and a positive campaign. Well, he asked me to get out of the campaign, outright offering me the number two job at DPI, and of course I declined. But that's when I realized he didn't have a desire to do the job. It seemed like he just wanted a golden parachute.
In response, Holtz called the proposal a rough draft of ideas assembled at the request of business leaders in hopes of the two candidates working with each other instead of running against each other. He also says it wasn't meant to force either candidate out of the race.
Molly Beck joins us now. She covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
John Humphreys has been making the rounds with this allegation, including an interview with your news outlet, the Wisconsin State Journal. What specifically did he have to say about this?
Well, on Wednesday, he told me that, or actually he supplied the document that this is all about. He sent me the letter that he says Lowell Holtz gave him on that December 22nd meeting in Milton. In that letter, while it doesn't explicitly say, you know, if you drop out of the race, here's what you'll get, it does, you know, have a list of terms that include, you know, $150,000 a year salary, a three-year contract, a job with a driver, and then has some powers that those jobs would have within DPI. And Humphreys, you know, kind of filled in the gaps for me when I asked him about it. He characterized it as, you know, what you just heard, that it was a proposal that Lowell Holtz gave him that would, you know, outline some scenarios under which one of them getting out of the race in exchange for a job at DPI should one of them, you know, succeed and defeat Tony Evers. Lowell Holtz has disputed that characterization. He says they're just ideas. They were ideas that some business leaders that neither candidate will name asked them to discuss, and that they never went anywhere.
And the certain powers that this job would entail included a control of a handful of major urban school districts and a shakeup in Milwaukee. What was this about?
Right. So the job that the document, you know, says that Lowell Holtz would have would be, it looks like a sort of superintendent of these handful of quote-unquote urban districts that have, you know, a significant population of low-income students and a diverse student enrollment. It's, you know, Milwaukee, Madison, Racine, Kenosha, Green Bay, those districts. And it outlines some things that job could do, including, you know, have control of the school board, be able to break up school districts if they wanted to, some pretty significant changes to those districts this position would be able to do.
And it seems like this breakfast meeting, these two candidates have very different characterizations of what was discussed and what went on.
Yeah, I mean, they agree that they met. They agree that the meeting was at the request of these business leaders that they won't identify. But it's the, you know, was this a real proposal or not, is what they're disputing right now.
Is this unusual to see something like this in this type of race?
I spoke to some political observers about that, and they've said that they think it's pretty unusual. I think it's the part that is most unusual is that it's in writing is what's most unusual.
We're talking with Molly Beck, who covers state politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. She's talking about these latest developments in the race for state superintendent of public instruction. And Molly, In looking at what these candidates are bringing to the race in this primary election on Tuesday, these two candidates, Humphreys and Holtz, what are their political leanings in their race?
Sure. Well, this is it's a nonpartisan race, but the two candidates that are seeking to defeat Tony Evers, they are, seeking support from conservative groups and conservative voters. That's, they're not identifying themselves as Republicans, but that's, who they're seeking the support from, because Tony Evers has a lot of support from public school advocates and Democrats. So while it's a nonpartisan race, it's kind of like the Supreme Court races. It's usually groups that identify with one party or the other, more or less, kind of get in and back these candidates.
How has the current superintendent, the incumbent here, Tony Evers, reacted to all of this? What is his campaign saying?
Today, they didn't say anything yesterday, but today they said that, they're very concerned about this, the part of the proposal that would allow this position to have the power over these school districts and, be able to make significant changes to the structure of school districts. I think his campaign manager called it a massive power grab. I'm trying to talk with DPI right now to see, how different this would be than what the powers the superintendent has right now.
Yeah. And what about this salary, $150,000? Does that type of salary exist in DPI, in the administration?
There's not a salary that I know of that is that high. When I spoke with the superintendent, he said that would be a raise for him. So, that salary level is seemingly high for DPI.
Is there considered to be a front runner in this race right now?
The people I talked to have said that they believe that Tony Evers will most definitely make it through the primary. It's tough to say between John Humphreys and Lowell Holtz who will prevail on Tuesday. For a while, it was, a lot of people just agreed that it would be John Humphreys. But Lowell Holtz's campaign has been a little bit more aggressive recently, so it's tough to say what will happen on Tuesday.
And with this new allegation coming out, this document, how that might play into what is happening in this race?
Right. It's obviously very early, so we'll have to see how this shakes out over the next couple of days. I talked to some people today that said that it could definitely, damage the credibility of one or both of those candidates involved.
And so what will you be watching for in the coming days?
Well, we're, following what the campaigns are doing. I know there's a debate tonight in Racine that at least Lowell Holtz and John Humphreys are expected to be at. So we'll see what happens.
Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck, who covers state politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about the latest developments in the race for state superintendent of public instruction.
At the beginning of the month, Wisconsin stopped covering health care services that would be of particular benefit to transgender state employees. The state's group insurance board had decided last summer that gender reassignment surgery and other associated treatments would be covered based on rules in the Affordable Care Act.
That decision went into effect on January 1st of this year, but 1 month later, the state backed out of covering particular services for transgender people. The State of Department of Employee Trust Fund said that it would reinstate its earlier exclusion of, quote, procedures, services, and supplies related to surgery and sex hormones associated with gender reassignment, end quote.
As Republicans on the Hill try to make good on their promises to repeal and replace Obamacare, questions remain about what kind of coverage transgender people in Wisconsin and beyond can get for gender reassignment services. Kellen Baker joins us now to tell us more. He's a senior fellow at the Progressive Public Policy Research and Advocacy Organization, the Center for American Progress. Kellen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, as things stand right now with the still existing Affordable Care Act, what federal rules are in place when it comes to transgender inclusive health benefits?
One of the major federal rules that's in place around the provision of healthcare services for transgender people is the Affordable Care Act. Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act still does protect transgender people, just as it protects all Americans who deserve the right to get the same services that anyone else would need without discrimination. The other important protection for transgender people when it comes to health insurance coverage and health care is actually Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in employment. So that's another major change that we're seeing in terms of the application of those civil rights protections for transgender people seeking coverage and care.
And then this has been subject to a legal challenge from a handful of states. Wisconsin has signed on to that challenge, as I understand it. What are the grounds behind that challenge?
The challenge to Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act is basically arguing that the expansion of protections for transgender people is not something that the Affordable Care Act intended to do. But as we're looking at what the law is trying to achieve, it is making sure that anybody, regardless of who they are, has the same access to the healthcare services that are medically necessary for them. So this challenge is trying to argue that the Affordable Care Act intended to carve out or exclude protections for transgender people, which I just don't think is the case.
The argument, I guess, would be that it didn't specifically include if it defined by sex, but didn't include a phrase like gender identity or something like that. Would that be the argument there that, well, it wasn't specifically included?
That's the basic idea. That's saying that because the words gender identity are not in the statute, that transgender people are not protected, which honestly is kind of the same as looking at the Constitution and saying because it says men, it doesn't protect women too.
Where is that particular legal challenge in the courts right now?
Currently, there is a preliminary injunction that has been issued by a federal judge in the North District of Texas. So that injunction applies nationwide, and what it means is that the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services cannot enforce the provisions of Section 1557 that would specifically protect transgender people from discrimination.
How have we seen insurance coverage, deal with this particular provision under the Affordable Care Act? First of all, with Wisconsin, with public providers of health care insurance for public workers.
It's actually really interesting because so much of the conversations that are happening around health insurance coverage are focusing on Section 1557, both for transgender people and for others. But actually, when it comes to the provision of coverage for trans people, the trends started before the Affordable Care Act, actually among employers. So even before the Affordable Care Act passed, we were starting to see major employers removing transgender-specific exclusions from their plans, looking at their non-discrimination statements or their EEOs and recognizing that a commitment to non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity needs to mean that they can't have insurance exclusions that target trans people. So over the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years, we have seen a significant wave of momentum that was really initiated by employers removing these exclusions, and now we're actually to the point where we have seen 19 states plus Washington, D.C., actually having insurance commissioners issue guidance clarifying that plans subject to state regulation cannot have transgender-specific exclusions because they discriminate against transgender people. And at least 10 state governments have taken the exact same step that Wisconsin did of removing the exclusion in their state employee plans to make it possible for transgender state employees to get the care that they need. So it's actually a significant wave of momentum that precedes the Affordable Care Act and I think is continuing despite setbacks such as what happened in Wisconsin or despite the uncertainty around the future of the Affordable Care Act itself.
Right. That's the end of that exclusion, which is kind of a double negative, but basically allowing the public worker coverage to cover this treatment for transgender people, transgender inclusive health care. That was in effect for a month, almost exactly. It came into effect January 1st, trying to comply with the Affordable Care Act, and then taken back off at the beginning of February under this court order. Have you seen other states make similar steps toward and then away from this coverage?
No, honestly, and it's very concerning to see Wisconsin taking this kind of step backwards, especially when it's not something that the Affordable Care Act or even the injunction against Section 1557 requires. All the Affordable Care Act does is say, please treat everyone fairly. And the injunction says, well, we're not sure what kind of requirements or what kind of penalties there may be for people who continue to exclude, but nowhere does the injunction say that you have to put these exclusions back in. That is a decision that was made purely by the board for reasons that I really unfortunately think are targeted at transgender Wisconsins in a way that that I find very concerning.
Do we have an idea of what expanding to this kind of coverage costs an employer or a state government?
There's actually been some studies that have come out over the last several years looking at the experience of employers. So one, for example, looking at the experience of Fortune 500 companies that had removed transgender exclusions from their plans. And what they found is that the cost of the expansion of coverage is minimal, negligible, zero. The legal term that keeps getting thrown around is de minimis, which really just means it doesn't actually cost anything. Because really what we're seeing here is there is this expectation that transgender care is expensive, but it's actually not, because most people really need hormone replacement therapy, and they may need specific surgeries that are medically necessary for them to treat gender dysphoria. But this is the kind of care that actually doesn't break the bank for an insurance company, but is incredibly important for transgender people who need it. Also, there was actually another study that came out of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in 2015 that looked at the cost-effectiveness of providing access to transition-related care, and actually found that it's significantly more cost-effective to provide access to the care that people need rather than depriving them of medically necessary health care and then trying to deal with the negative consequences.
Talking to Kellen Baker from the Center for American Progress about coverage, insurance coverage of gender reassignment treatments, surgery, hormones, and more. Wisconsin briefly allowed that for a month and then switched at the beginning of this month again to not covering that for state employees. Kellen, I think some people might be listening and hearing the phrase gender dysphoria and the phrase medically necessary and thinking, you know, if you have a heart attack, it's medically necessary to get treated for that. If you have a disease, the antibiotics might be medically necessary. People maybe not familiar with transgender issues might say this is optional. This is something that they can choose to do or not. Therefore, it doesn't need to be covered. What would you say to them?
Really, when it comes to the medical necessity of transition-related care for transgender people, don't take my word for it. I'm not a doctor. What we should be taking the word for it is coming from the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. The list goes on and on of all of the major medical associations in the United States that have publicly stated that gender-affirming care for transgender people is medically necessary, that gender dysphoria is a real and serious condition for which there exists real treatments that actually make people better.
I want to look at the road ahead on this issue now, and it seems like there's a few different paths. There's the courts, there's what happens with the Affordable Care Act, and then what happens with the employers you were talking about earlier. Let's start in the courts. We have this injunction in place. Is there a challenge? Is this something that's going to end up at the Supreme Court?
I think what a lot of us are expecting is that this will be part of the discussion around the case that's going to the Supreme Court regarding access to facilities for transgender people in schools under Title IX. So looking at the question of the degree to which, from a legal perspective, the term sex does include gender identity. I think all of us lay people would sort of look at gender identity and realize, well, obviously that has to do with your sex. The question that will be before the Supreme Court is how that plays out exactly in the law. So I think a lot of us, I for one, don't expect any further action specifically on 1557 from any other courts before we hear from the Supreme Court in June.
And then in Congress, of course, a lot of attention to the idea of repealing the Affordable Care Act, replacing it with something. If that provision in the Affordable Care Act is taken out, does that change the landscape?
I think the key word in your question, honestly, is something. I, for one, would love to see what plan Republicans in Congress are proposing to replace the Affordable Care Act, since the Affordable Care Act itself is a Republican proposal. So when it comes to finding a cheaper way to make it possible for more people to get access to private health insurance coverage and to make it possible for them to use that coverage to get care, I don't know that there's any better option out there than the Affordable Care Act.
Now, supposing Congress gets rid of this provision in the Affordable Care Act, the courts don't change the tune on this current injunction, do you think that employers, whether public employers or private employers, will still see this trend toward more coverage of transgender-inclusive health benefits?
I do. You know, as we were talking about the trend that started actually among employers before the Affordable Care Act, recognizing that, you know, not supporting people in getting the health care that they need is not a good business practice. So I think we're going to see, we've seen over the last several years a real explosion in the number of employers who are providing inclusive coverage for their transgender employees and coming out with the experience that it doesn't actually cost anything. I mean, when you look at the number of transgender people, the most recent estimates out there are about 1.4 million transgender people in the United States. That's about 0.45% of the population overall. And the same is true of Wisconsin. Looking at the numbers for Wisconsin specifically, it's less than half a percentage point of the state's population who are transgender. So this isn't about breaking the bank or spending money that we don't have. It's about making it possible for people to be who they truly are.
We'll leave it there for now. Kellen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That was Kellen Baker, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He joins us to talk about health care benefits for transgender state employees after Wisconsin stopped covering gender reassignment surgery and other treatments for state workers earlier this month.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at why millennials aren't running for office and what, if anything, can be done to make a career in politics appeal to members of this generation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The wealth gap between black and white people in the United States is no secret, but our guest says that all the explanations we had for the wealth gap, like education differences, savings differences, they don't always hold true.
First, even though today's young people are surrounded by more political news than ever before, there's a growing trend that's causing concern for some. Despite that exposure to politics, millennials just don't seem to be interested in actually running for office. It's got a lot of people in the political world asking why.
Our next guest wanted to get to the bottom of that question. To do so, surveyed nearly 800 graduate students at some of the most prestigious government and law colleges in the nation. So these are people you'd think, hey, they're prime candidates to run for office. They had a clear consensus. They're passionate about making a difference in the world, but feel like politics isn't the best way to do that.
Shauna Shames joins us now. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and the author of Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. Shauna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you started this research, you had a different question that you were asking. You were looking into why more women and people of color don't run for office. But then you realized this question wasn't the question you should go after. There was something bigger here. What happened? How did your research change?
So what I was doing first was gathering information on men as well as women. And my thought there was, well, I need to have something to compare the women to. And my initial interest was in the low numbers of women interested in running for office. The more I studied this topic, the more I wondered if race might have something to do with it as well as gender. So I expanded the topic. But when I started collecting the data and actually looking through and talking to, you know, doing the actually talking to people thing that we occasionally do as research scientists, right? What I realized is that I had it wrong. It wasn't men versus women. It certainly wasn't black versus white or Hispanic. That there were not that many people who really wanted to run for office at all. So my control group was not at all a control group. And I should talk about that bigger, the bigger question, the bigger trend that I was finding. It was one of my dissertation advisors said, well, you should make the bug the program.
So you sat down for these interviews. What were these Harvard graduate students in the Kennedy School and Harvard Law and your alma mater, by the way, what were they telling you?
So first of all, I want to say what a wonderful group of kind of idealistic and optimistic young people these were. There's a stereotype of millennials as being kind of self-obsessed or selfie-taking, and I'm sure there is plenty of that. But if you only look at social media, you get a very biased view of millennials. This is such a bright and thoughtful and caring group of people that I talked to, that I was very impressed with their kind of desire to make a difference in the world. But also as a political scientist, I started getting not only impressed, but somewhat depressed about their kind of negativity about the actual act of running for office. And the more I listened to them, the more I thought, well, it makes sense. It's not an irrational thing. It's a very rational set of reasons that they have for not wanting to run. But boy, it bummed me out.
Well, some of the reasons were caught my attention. One was the ick factor.
Right.
What's the ick factor?
All right. So if you think about the role of money in campaign funding and the way that we do campaigns, first of all, most countries in the world, I think most democracies think we are nuts for the way that we fund our campaigns, that individual candidates have to basically set up a money gathering business. And that's most of what a campaign is in this country. There were two big problems that my interviewees and survey respondents saw in that process. And the first one was just the simple act of asking for money feels a little bit like uncomfortable to most people. I had one interviewee tell me that, you know, even when her parents try to shove $20 in her pocket when she's going back to school, she finds that uncomfortable. You know, so the idea of just having most of your time be about asking people to give you money, so that felt icky in a way. But the larger ick factor that I talk about in the book is this, it's almost related to the second piece of the process. So not only do you have to ask for money, but then you have to accept it. And the large amounts of money that go into a campaign that you would then have to accept, and they felt particularly from interest groups or from corporations, they felt like this might compromise them. It would compromise their morals or their ethics or their principles or even just their ability to focus on the issues that they cared about. Because logically, if you take a whole lot of money from people, you have to at least think about their issues. It doesn't mean you have to do it. I don't think it felt like outright corruption. But there was something of an ick factor that I thought was pretty rational that that these really bright students were seeing.
And you say that both costs and rewards matter greatly to someone considering running for office. Is there a sense that the rewards of serving just aren't high enough for this generation?
Sure. That was the biggest surprised me in these data. I did not start out with a costs and rewards framework to this research. It was a totally different question I was starting out with. So when I started to look at the data in terms of so many people weren't wanting to run for office, and we often in political science assume that, you know, people do, that that's a worthy goal, that people would like to hold office and see that as important. So when I started to question that assumption and talk and think about what were the rewards that people were telling me about, there were some. There were some people who thought that you could get a lot out of running for office and maybe a lot out of serving the public in that way. But on the whole, and I do this kind of very elaborate adding up of all of the costs that people saw and then all of the potential rewards, on the whole, these were about equal or maybe a little behind the zero line for a lot of the people. It meant that the rewards just don't balance out the costs. And that can be fatal to, you know, what we call political ambition, wanting to run for office.
And one of the factors that you put forth was that salaries in these jobs in public service just aren't up there.
Right.
So holding these elected positions, they don't pay that well. And these are Harvard Law School and Kennedy School students who could go out in the private sector and make a ton of more money. So how does that factor in?
So this was indeed a factor for a whole lot of people. And interestingly, for me, this is where race came in. The non-white students were much more concerned about what we would call the opportunity cost of a foregone private sector salary. And then particularly in politics, which is a career ladder type of field, except, you know, if you're the president, you can jump in. The current president can jump in and run for president. Most people can't. You usually have to start at the bottom and work your way up from a lower level political office. Those lower level political offices often aren't paid, or they're paid very poorly. And that means that people who could be really high quality candidates might face this large opportunity cost. I found particularly for the Hispanic, Asian American, and Black students in my sample that they were worried about that because they felt this obligation to support other members of their family, not just the children that they had or expected to have, but their siblings or their parents, right? So the financial costs were actually significant.
We're talking with Shauna Shames. She's the author of the book Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. Shauna, what does this say then for American politics going forward as politics tries to bring in people who reflect a whole across the spectrum of age and race and gender? Where are we headed?
So the results that I have found about where we currently are somewhat depressing to me, because I'm a feminist and I want to see a more diverse cadre of people in office in terms of race, in terms of age, in terms of gender. So the initial feeling that you might get from, you know, reading my book or even hearing the title is somewhat depressing. But I want everybody to know that it just because it is that way right now, or because young people seem to have a negative view of politics, it doesn't mean it has to be that way. And I think even in the last couple weeks, we've seen such a surge of interest in politics and such activism that it gives me real hope that a generation that maybe has felt distanced from politics might be coming to understand that the government is not them, right here in what we hope is an American democracy. The government is us, and if you don't run for office, other people will, and they may not be who you'd want. So I'm somewhat depressed by my own results, but I am very hopeful that if we can show young people that politics matters and that it can make a difference and make the world a better place, rather than, I think right now they're seeing politics as being the problem. I think it's up to us to show young people that politics can solve problems. And so far, we haven't been doing enough of that. I'm hopeful for the future that if we do that better, young people will respond.
We're talking right now with political scientist Shauna Shames about why millennials are shying away from running for elected office and what could that mean for the future of American politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a millennial, have you ever considered a career in politics or even just running for local office? Why or why not? What do you see as the risks, the rewards? Do you feel like you could really make a difference if you got elected? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Shauna Shames, author of the book Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. She says few people in that younger generation are interested in serving political office, and that's a problem. We're talking about what that could mean for the future of American politics and what could change.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think can be done to make politics a more enticing career choice for millennials or for any age group for that matter? If you are a millennial and have run for office, why did you do it? Let's hear from you. What called you to politics? And just what are the implications if we don't get more young people running for office? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go right away to our callers with Dominic from Madison. Hi, Dominic.
Hello.
What would you like to add? Yes, hi.
Well, I would just like to say that. So I am a Latino male, and I live in Wisconsin. And I think that part of the piece to this is understanding that I do agree. I think that what we're going to see is less career politicians and more younger people getting involved in politics later on, not necessarily as a career choice, but as a sense of obligation to serve the community. So I think the values are going to remain the same to be involved. But what I think is that, I'm involved in a local county park board. And so if we put the emphasis on helping people get involved in the process of governance, that is an important segue. That's, a way to get involved, to gain experience in public administration. Now, that's a different lure of serving your community, what it's supposed to be about. What I think is important, rather than having people to say that, hey, there are wonderful salaries in politics and jump into it because there's a career for you. I'm involved in local governments because, I want to have a direct impact on my community and the community that I live in. So I just think that, expanding diversity to new audiences and bringing new members, because I'm an older millennial, I think is an opportunity for people to get involved rather than for people to look at, jumping into politics as a career.
Shauna?
Yeah, it's such an excellent point. And I love, Dominic, how you talk about serving your community. It turns out that's such an important reward. And if you can make people think that's what politics is, right, if we could reframe politics as solving problems collectively or working together to make the community better, that suddenly makes people more interested in wanting to run, from what I can tell in the data. And the interesting thing about the salaries, I don't mean to suggest that we should, want people who are wanting to run because of the salary. That's not who I would want either. I want people like you, Dominic. But I think that the low salary as a cost seems particularly problematic when it's paired with this sense of, there's no other compensating reward. For Latinos and Latinas and Black men and women in my sample, especially, it was this idea of helping their communities that would be the greatest reward. But unfortunately, a whole lot of them weren't sure that politics was the way to do that. So that's what I'd love to see, people like you saying that I can help by serving on my local county park board. I think that's wonderful.
Dominic, thanks for your call. Let's go to Jackie now in Ashland. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there.
What would you like to add?
I was just calling in as a millennial who served on my local city council in Ashland, Wisconsin, and previously served on the school board. There's a cohort of younger folks up here who are pretty involved in the political process, partisan-wise and just non-partisan-wise, but it's the giving back aspect. If you're familiar with Ashland, Wisconsin and where we're situated on Lake Superior, we have a really rich history and a growing, aging population. At the end of the day, the next generation of folks are going to be the ones making decisions for the future of the town, and I'm the one who's going to be here, and I want to be able to have a voice and represent the other people in this community to ensure that Ashland is here for another 100 years.
Jackie, I want to ask you, is that your main job, or do you do something else besides being in politics?
Oh, no, definitely. I have a 9-to-5. I work up in Northland College. So I do that during the day, and then I, along with a colleague of mine, he served as the president of the city council, actually, and he's a year younger than me. So I wouldn't say that millennials are inherently not interested. It's just recognizing the balance and the demands of life. I mean, I know people are tired of hearing about it, but we have student loans to pay. We need to have 9-to-5 jobs. We can't, the demands of being on city council or even school board are a lot. And if you're going to do it well, and, if you can't find that balance between homework and other activities, then how can someone run to be on a county board or a city council when I don't have kids. If I had kids, I don't know how I would do it.
Shauna?
This is exactly what I hear from other millennials that I've talked to. And there are those like Jackie who I think have the inclination, right? I think it's wonderful that you're involved and that you have this understanding that if we don't do this, who does, right? That's a wonderful sense of ownership over one's own government. But boy, the demands of paying rent, that's real. Student loans, it's a real thing. And so I think the best way I can think to get young people to be interested in running for office is just that it has to feel meaningful. Because if you're going to work 9 to 5 like Jackie, and then you have to go to a school board meeting for like 3 or 4 hours in the evening, which is exhausting, right? You really have to feel like it's making a difference. So it's not just that the costs are high, I found, but it's the kind of lack of feeling that the rewards are meaningful that I think is really devastating.
Jackie, thanks so much for calling in. And now David in La Crosse. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What would you like to add?
It's a very fruitful discussion. I would just like to add, so I've served for just about wrapping up my 4th year on city council over here in La Crosse. And we have other young people that serve on council and on county board too. So I don't see the same, discrepancy between youth and willingness to serve. It's certainly a sacrifice, but it's also certainly rewarding. I mean, I think, I work for Baron Pizza Money on council. So it's the other rewards that you can get out of it. But the larger challenge is, so I also have a master's degree from an Ivy League university. And if I look at this, I survey the political landscape, and what you see is that, if I wanted to go anywhere else, like if I wanted to run for state assembly or state senate, like those seats are locked up. And this is particularly true in the Democratic Party. Not so much if you look at the wider landscape of Wisconsin politics, you'll see that the GOP like elevates its younger leaders, and there's lots of young people in assembly seats who then can transfer onto Senate seats and kind of build a bullpen. But what happens for us is, if I look at my district, our Senate, our assembly people and our congressional district, they're all in their mid-50s. So we're not really building a bullpen of where can those candidates go. And if I were to choose to run for an actual position that would pay, it would mean literally primarying someone in my own party. So,
Shauna, what do you think about career politicians and not building up a base of young people to move in to these positions?
Well, yes, it's all very discouraging. I'm glad to hear from David that he sees a lot of young people. And maybe my conclusions, it seems like they don't hold in Wisconsin, man. This is like, what a great state for young people running, apparently. You guys are doing good. But the idea that the state assembly seats are totally locked up is a really strong deterrent to people who might want to then run for office and then run for higher office. If there's no seat to be had within the Democratic Party, that's very demoralizing, right? This is yet another problem, I think, with the kind of intense partisan gerrymandering that we see, which has been in the past couple decades growing and in protecting incumbents. But what it ends up doing is vastly decreasing competition. And we know that kind of thinking that you could win is one of the greatest incentives that gets somebody to run for office. So it's not just money. I mean, the idea of incumbents almost always win, and there's very few seats where there's not an incumbent already sitting on it, right? That's a demoralizing thing. It goes back to my point about, boy, young people are not dumb here. They're looking at this system that we have set up with intensive partisan gerrymandering, intensive protection of incumbents, and this really weird quasi-corrupt feeling about campaign finance. It's no wonder to me that a whole lot of them are saying, that's not where I want to spend my time.
Well, Shauna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
That was Shauna Shames. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden. She's the author of Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. And you can leave your comments about this and on the Central Time Facebook page.
Especially if you're a millennial who has run for office, we'd love to hear your story. The Central Time Facebook page. It's the end of an era in the world of board gaming. The voters have spoken. The Thimble is out.
The Thimble was one of the classic pieces in Monopoly, but the game company Hasbro held a month-long vote to see if fans of the game wanted to get rid of one of the pieces. They announced the results today, and the Thimble got the thumbs down.
Or the finger. The contest brought in over 4 million votes, and the Thimble will join the old-fashioned iron on the ash heap of Monopoly history.
The Thimble will be replaced, however, by a token that will be announced next month on World Monopoly Day, of course. And the new No Thimble edition will be released in August.
Did you have a playing piece of choice, Kate?
Top hat.
You were top hat. I don't play Monopoly much anymore. Not my favorite game. I play a lot of games. But when I did, Battleship was number one, and the top hat would have been my second choice. Thimble, I mean, thanks to Monopoly, I know what a thimble is.
I looked up some of the meanings
behind. I'm not a sewing guy.
Yeah, I looked up the meanings quickly behind all of these little pieces. Mm-hmm. You are cutthroat in playing, but you have an artistic flair.
That sounds like me.
Makes sense.
Well, if you're looking for old Monopoly pieces, there's just one place to go. This is Central Time.
On a blanket with my babies, where I'll be. Under the boardwalk.